When you have a chance, I have a monster question.
Okay.
Okay.
Is it urgent?
Sorry?
Is it pressing for today?
It's not pressing for today. Okay. I'd like to do what I do face to face, though.
Then we'll take care of it.
So.
Okay. If it was urgent for today, we'd take care of it today.
If we wait till Thursday, if that's what we're thinking, yes, absolutely.
It's been a tough couple of years.
Okay, let's get started.
One of my suicide things. I don't want to bother him. Sure, I'm suicide.
I came prepared today.
Oh, okay. Everyone knows. Everyone knows that suicide is wrong, and you know, cynical people like me always want to look at the other opinion. There's always another opinion out there. You know, the opinion of Rav Yaakov Emden, who was a great fan of suicide. Rav Yaakov Emden deals with the case of someone who has committed an aveira, a sin, which carries the death penalty in the Torah, and he feels so sad about having committed a sin, an aveira, which carries the death penalty. And we don't have today a bet din. We do not have a rabbinical court which can judge capital cases. And he feels so bad. He needs death in order to atone for the sin he did, so he kills himself. Zechut he lo. That's a great merit for that person, according to Rav Yaakov Emden. I just point out there's another opinion out there.
That's not taken out of context?
I've learned over the last year is what is the definition of suicide?
Yeah, okay. Okay. The rabbis through the generations have made the definition of suicide so difficult to fulfill that there are no practical cases of it. Okay, but really, really, assisted suicide is just a polite way of saying euthanasia, killing someone who's suffering, and everyone knows you're not allowed to do that. Everyone knows you're not allowed to kill someone, even though he or she is suffering. Everyone knows euthanasia is wrong. Well, let's see the other side of the issue. Let's see the other opinion here. And it turns out that the other opinion is no less than the Shulchan Aruch itself, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and all the other great rabbis happen to be on the pro-euthanasia side of this particular issue. Let's see what they say. According to Shulchan Aruch, Hagoses, now Goses is someone who is very sick and about to die. The exact definition of Goses is a little bit problematic. There are contemporary poskim, like Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who say we do not know how to define exactly who is and who is not Goses, and therefore there's no practical application of any of these halachot. Except maybe in certain unusual cases. What about someone who is brain dead? Someone who is brain dead, the brain stem, it's the geza hamoach, the brain stem, which controls autonomous breathing, which controls the heart function, cardiac function. And if the brain stem is dead, so the patient is unable to breathe by himself or by herself, the patient is unable to have any cardiac function. As you know, out there in the big wide world, brain death in many places in the world is considered death, And at that point, you can harvest organs and estates transfer to inheritors, and the spouses are no longer married because the spouses died. Now remarriage becomes a possibility. There are many places in the world where brain death is considered death. And Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is not quite sure about whether or not halacha acknowledges brain death, but someone who is brain dead is at least a goses. Someone who is brain dead is at least a goses. That even Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach would agree to. There are plenty of other poskim. There are some other poskim who embrace brain death as being halachic death, but that's a controversial issue which we're not going to get into today. In any event, hagoses, someone who's on the verge of death, some great rabbis, like Rav David Halevi, was the Rav HaRashi, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, for many, 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 he died around 5 years ago, but for many years he was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. He held that establishing who is and who is not a goses is really very simple. All you have to do is ask the attending physician. And this is the question you ask the attending physician. Is there, according to the laws of nature, a miracle? So let's forget about miracles. We don't care about miracles at the moment. Aside from a miracle, is there any hope that this patient is going to survive? If the attending physician says, aside from a miracle, there is no way this patient is going to survive, so the physician has told you that the patient is a goses. So there are poskim who are willing to work with the idea of goses. There are others who find it very problematic.
Is that without a time frame? Survive for what period of time? Or just
recover from the condition. That is, what makes a terminal condition a terminal condition? That the patient is not going to recover from this lesion, from this particular disease entity. That's what makes the patient a goses. Goses, even though he or she is about to die, harehu kachai l'chol dvarav, halachically speaking, he or she is not yet dead, and therefore is 100% considered to be alive. And therefore, you're not allowed to do anything which is normally done after death. Back in those days, they used to suture together, they used to sew together the cheeks, the lechayim, and therefore, ein koshrim lechayav, you can't sew together, you can't suture together the cheeks, which is something they did after death, prior to a minig they had. Today we have other minhagim, Chavar Gadish has other minhagim today. You can't do it until he's dead. Ein sachinoto, you cannot anoint the body with oil. Back in those days they used to anoint the body with oil prior to burial. Ein medichinoto, you cannot rinse the body, well that we still do. Ein pokakin et nikavav, you cannot stop up his bowels. They used to plug up the bowels to prevent anything from coming out prior to burial. We don't do that anymore. Ein shomtim akar metachtav, you can't remove the pillow from underneath the patient's head until he is actually dead. Ein notnim oto al gabei chol, you cannot place the body of the patient on sand, lo al gabei charsit, not on shards of pottery, lo al gabei adama, you can't put the body on the earth. This minhag is still done today. Today, at least in Eretz Yisrael, the body is put on the ground. The Chevra Kadisha, once death has been established, will put the body on the ground because the ground is not makabel tuma. And then when they're ready to move the body to the building where they're going to prepare it for burial, they do that. But you can't. This is something you do after death, so you can't do it until death has been verified. Ein notnim al kreso, lo ka'ara, lo magrefa, lo tzluchit shomayim, lo gagir shokemach. There are all kinds of things which they used to place on the body after death in order to enable the soul to depart and enter Gan Eden, a bowl, a shovel, a bottle of water, a lump of salt. You can't put any of this stuff on the body of the patient because all that's done after death.
We're just going to skip over all those things?
Those are menhagim they had. You're wondering why. So, but worse, you're going to wonder why they do the things they do today.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you get to know,
actually. Boy, oh, boy.
They do crazy stuff like this.
Boy, oh, boy, oh, boy.
How does that go into superstition? And
yeah, this is a whole separate thing, how menhagim come to be and how they stop being. We're not going to get into that now.
Menhagim. Menhagim's a big problem.
Eith mashmim ala ayarot. You cannot inform the people in the towns that he's dead until he's actually dead. You can't send around the sound trucks and say, get ready for the funeral. Get ready, we're anticipating the big funeral of Rabbi so-and-so. You can't say that until he's actually dead.
Could you write the obituary?
I work with the neighbor quite often. In pastor,
write it for yourself.
We received the call, or she received the call, reserving her for a funeral. When's the funeral?
Don't know
we
yet.
Don't have a body yet.
Yeah, no, you're not. According to this, you're not allowed.
It took like 5 days later.
According to this, you're not allowed. According to this, you're not allowed. The we'll come to this issue also.
Writing the obituary.
There's a halacha in the Shulchan Aruch. Not many people. There are tons of halachas in the Shulchan Aruch that people don't know about. One of the halachas in the Shulchan Aruch is you're not allowed to say so and so died. Just the words, so-and-so died, is lashon hara. You're saying something bad about that person, and you're not allowed to say so-and-so died. But Rav Zonenfeld, the great rabbi of Yerushalayim, said you're not allowed to say it by your mouth, by pronouncing the words. Printing a notice in the newspaper is okay.
You're not allowed to speak those words that somebody was nifter?
Correct. So and so died
until they
is usher because after someone has died, you're not allowed to say so and so has died.
How are you supposed to tell someone that?
As with every other halacha of lashon hara, if it is true and if it is mitoelet for the benefit of someone who's going to have to, going to say Kaddish, for example. So if you have a clear benefit and it's true, then you can say it. But just to inform someone that so-and-so died, no.
Well, if they come to the funeral because they know that he has died, then
that's... Oh, so this will be a toelet. This will be a toelet. Okay, but you need a toelet. You cannot hire flute players for the funeral. And you cannot hire women to wail. You know, if you've ever been to a Near Eastern funeral, you know how the women wail. If you ever wondered whether or not there's a prohibition of music in times of mourning, you have just learned the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch that it's correct to hire musicians for the funeral. You just can't hire them until the person is dead. But there's no objection to a funeral march. There's no objection to sad music accompanying the funeral. That's exactly what the Shulchan Aruch is talking about. And of course they hired musicians in those days for the funeral.
Bowls of water on the stomach of the person.
Correct, they did. They did.
So maybe not a great
food. Correct, they did. Ein ma'atzvei nav, atzvei nafsho. You cannot close the eyes until the patient is actually dead. Closing the eyes is something that they did prior. We still do that prior to burial. Kol ha-me'amet im yitziat ha-nefesh. Anyone who closes the patient's eyes while he is dying, while she is dying, but not yet dead, hareza shofech damim, that is spilling blood, that is shedding blood, that's you're killing the patient. Not allowed to do that. Indeed, you're not allowed to move the patient while the patient is a gosess, because the slightest movement of the patient might kill him might kill her, and you're simply not allowed to do that. This creates a big problem in hospital emergency rooms. In hospital emergency rooms, if you have a patient on a gurney in the emergency room in the hospital, and the medical staff has come to the conclusion that there is nothing else to be done for this patient. We've done all we can. There's nothing more to be done. This patient is going to die presently, and there's nothing we can do to help. And meanwhile, the patient is on a gurney in the middle of the emergency room where traffic moving back and forth is a big issue. After all, the staff in the emergency room has to be able to move back and forth between patients very quickly. And this patient is blocking in the middle of traffic. What are you supposed to do? You're not allowed to move that patient because moving the patient might kill the patient, and therefore some thought has to be given in advance about how the patients are going to be organized, how they're going to be physically placed in the emergency room.
Is moving the patient, is that the patient himself or the bed that is
any slightest movement?
You defined a ghost as earlier as someone whom the doctor says is not going
to
recover.
According
from
to
their
one opinion.
Yeah, okay. But if you have a situation like that, you could have someone like that who could still live for a little while.
Sure.
You might need to move the patient for comfort.
Ah, well, of course. You're allowed to violently move the patient. You're allowed to perform surgery on the patient. You can perform all kinds of violence on the body of the patient if there's some reasonable expectation that it's going to help. But if there's no reasonable expectation that it's going to help, then the slightest movement is prohibited.
Well, I was thinking along the lines of moving the patient to avoid bed sores if the patient might
recommend
them.
Oh, very well. Yes, of course. Pressure sores.
Yeah,
bed sores.
Exactly.
Of course. Or anything else,
anything
which is going to make the patient more comfortable. Well, of course.
Okay.
That's helpful. That's something you can do.
Okay.
You can even inject the patient with morphine. You could infuse morphine, which is a fairly violent, invasive procedure. And it's true that injecting morphine will, in addition to relieving pain, morphine really does relieve pain. You're suffering. Morphine is good. Morphine really works. If you ever have to go to the proverbial desert island and you can only take one medicine with you, morphine is the medicine which always works for every disease. It really works. On the other hand, it also suppresses respiration. And if we're talking about a patient who anyway is very sick, terminal, whatever the disease entity happens to be, whether it's trauma or cancer, whatever it is, these patients anyway probably have great difficulty breathing, and the morphine is going to suppress respiration. The morphine is dangerous. But the truth is, every medicine is dangerous. There's no such thing as a medicine which is not dangerous. They're all dangerous.
It's true that it's dangerous for trouble breathing, but it also relieves air hunger and therefore makes the
patient That's true. It relieves air hunger. It makes the patient feel better.
That they don't panic about not being able to breathe.
They feel better.
Your mom has to wake you up and remind you to breathe.
Yeah.
Look, every medicine, the
Rambam already taught us in the 12th century that any medicine which affects the body is dangerous if used improperly. And if the medicine is useless and doesn't affect the body at all, so who cares? But any medicine which really does affect the functioning of the body is dangerous. And morphine can kill, is when allowed to inject morphine, is when allowed to administer any medicine which might have horrible, disastrous results. Well, if one's intention is therapeutic, if you have a good intention, a therapeutic intention, it's permitted to administer the medicine, even though there's a possibility of catastrophic results there. That possibility always exists.
Is it a given that in moving a patient to psychosis that the movement is going to kill him?
It might.
It seems like
it might. The possibility. Mm-hmm. And there's no benefit to it. It's not therapeutic. So
you can't
take the chance. Correct. Em Kor'im, the relatives who would tear their clothing, the immediate family, which tears their clothing after death, cannot tear until after the death. Lo Choltim, can't take off your shoes, right? The immediate family, which take off their shoes for mourning, can't do it until after death. Lo Maspidim Alav, you can't make a eulogy, a hesped for him. Lo Machnisimo Aron Labayat Achiyamut, you can't bring the coffin into the house until he's actually dead. You know, just imagine, here's the patient, Goses, dying, terminal, whatever the problem is, and he sees them bringing in the coffin, getting ready, you know.
For the guy next door.
Yeah, no, since so much depends upon the attitude of the patient, you know, it's prohibited to do anything which is going to have a bad influence on the attitude of the patient.
The patient is in a coma or otherwise unconscious.
Yeah, no, low plug. Rav Moshe Feinstein says, and here the neurologists agree with him, or maybe it's the other way around, I don't know, there is agreement between Rav Moshe Feinstein and neurologists today. We do not know, it is not known, what goes on in the mind of a comatose patient. The question arises, does a comatose patient have any awareness of what's going on around him? Can a comatose patient hear? No one knows exactly the answer to this question. If you have a friend, a relative, a neighbor who's in a coma, and you visit him or her in the hospital, it makes sense to speak to that patient. It's unknown whether or not the patient actually can hear you, but maybe, until proven otherwise, it's possible that the patient has awareness of what's going on around them, and one should take that into account.
The taking off shoes, like if you were in the house of the person and he was aware of you taking off shoes, and you're one of the people who would, it would be important for you to take off your shoes, so you should purposely not.
Yeah, or even put on your shoes. Even put on your shoes. When the famous Rav Soloveitchik of Boston, Yeshiva University, his wife was dying of cancer in the hospital. At the time when the Rav's brother, that is, her brother-in-law, died, he was sitting Shiva. But even though he was sitting Shiva, he continued to visit her every day in the hospital. But before he went into her room, he put on shoes. She shouldn't notice that he was in mourning. That would depress her, and you can't do anything which will adversely affect the attitude of the dying patient.
That's a what if question.
Yeah.
What if you're a Kohen? Can you leave the room?
No. It follows that you cannot, because then the patient will say, "Oh, he's left the room because he thinks I'm about to die." No, you can't do that. Correct.
Some of these things, at least today, we don't do after the death. We do after the levaya.
No. Kriya, the ripping of the clothes should still be done today by anyone, relative or not. Anyone who is present at the moment of death should do kriya, should do tearing today.
I asked that exact question because there was a real possibility at one point that I could be with my mother when she died, and I was told by the person I asked, no, you don't tear kriya in the room, because they were afraid that if people knew they were going to have to tear kriya, they would be reluctant to be with the person at the end.
This indeed is the reason that many contemporary rabbis give for not following this particular halacha.
The reason was that if you people knew that they were going to have to tear kriya, they would be reluctant to be with the person at the end.
For hospital staff, it's fairly common, right? The number of deaths in hospitals are understandably very high. In hospitals where the medical staff is typically wearing an outer garment, a cloak, a chaluk, that does not belong to the medical staff. It belongs to the hospital. This is, if the cloak is property of the hospital, so the nurses, the physicians have no right to tear a garment which belongs to someone else. They are surely exempt. Although some of the frum, really frum doctors and nurses have their own cloaks that they wear for this purpose, and they have a lot of tears in them. There are people who do it.
Like a grim reaper doctor.
You would think so. But it's okay. It's okay because it's very frum. You can count the number of tears, right? So, al kol panim, what we understand is you can't do anything in preparation for the patient's death. Now the Haggadah, now it gets interesting with what the Haggadah adds, the Ramah. Yesh omrim dein chotzvim lo kever, you're not even allowed to dig a grave. Afal pi she'enu imo b'bayit ad achar she'yamut, even though we're in a different place, the patient is dying at home, and the cemetery is who knows how many kilometers away, you're still not allowed to dig the grave, because the patient might hear about it, might learn that his grave has been dug. In any event, you're not allowed to leave open holes in the ground overnight, because that's dangerous. Someone might fall into the hole. So, in general, you're not allowed to dig holes and leave them exposed overnight. And now he comes to the important part.
I'm sorry. Doesn't the second precept... Why do you need the first thing if you already have the second?
Yeah, well, even if you're expecting him to die over the next hour, then it's not going to be overnight. Even if you think you're going to use it very quickly, you still can't dig it until he's actually dead.
But the first thing is you can't dig it over there, yeah, even though he's over here. But we can't dig it over there anyhow.
Then that's for overnight. You can't leave an open pit overnight. Anyway, it has nothing to do with a grave. Any open pit you're not allowed to leave overnight.
This is amputation.
Yeah.
The patient is recovering but is in danger.
Sure.
But yet the limb is being, the grave is being dug. At the same time as the patient is in danger.
Yeah. Yeah. The treatment of amputated limbs or organs which have been removed, excisional biopsies of organs or whatever, or tissues, this material does not, strictly speaking, require burial. There is an Iser Hana, and it must be buried, but it doesn't have to be buried. It requires burial, but not burial. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Let me see if I can explain this a little bit.
You don't need the ceremony.
You don't need a Jewish cemetery with all of the halachot of burial. All you need is, it has to be in the ground somewhere. You can do it in your garden, in the backyard, if you want. Right. No real burial is required. The reason is because it's asur b'hana'a, and there's a prohibition of bizayon. You're not allowed to treat the amputated limbs with disrespect. In modern hospital settings, these are biohazardous materials, and there are special ways of taking care of them. But as long as it's done with respect, all is well. Now let's get to the important part. The chen asur legrom lemet sheyamut mehera. The Hebrew is such a complicated language. You all speak Russian? No? Czech, Polish, some Slavic language? I tried to explain. Yeah? They don't speak Russian. I explain. In all languages, it's just more clear in Russian, but all languages have the same thing. Verbs in all languages divide into two categories. Some verbs talk about actions or activities which are durative and go over a period of time. Other verbs talk about actions or activities that take place at one point in time. Now, in Russian, this difference is very important, because in Russian, just about every verb in the language has two forms, one for the durative, the imperfect, one for the perfective, one point in time. In Russian, just about every verb has two forms for this. So if you learn Russian, it's sort of obvious what you're talking about. In other languages, you have to figure out whether or not the verb is referring to duration or one point in time. It is prohibited to cause the dying patient, that's a durative verb, to die in one point in time. That is, you can't do anything to kill the dying patient. That means euthanasia is prohibited. You cannot do anything to cause the death of the dying patient. That's pretty simple and straightforward, isn't it? Euthanasia is prohibited. Kagon, for example. Mishu goses zman rav, zman aroch. Someone who's a terminal patient of whatever it is for a long, long time is a terminal patient. Can go on for a long time. And he or she is suffering, I suppose. Lo yuchal hipared. The soul is unable to depart. He can't die. You know, he or she might want to die because the patient is suffering a lot and is dragging on for a long time. The patient might want to die, but is unable to. The soul does not depart. Asur lehishamet akar v'keset mitachtav. It is prohibited to remove the pillow or the cushion from underneath the patient. And why would you want to do that? Mekoach shomrim, because they say, sheyesh notzot miktzat ofot gormim lazeh. They say that feathers of certain birds prolong life. That's what they believed. Back then, they believed that the reason the patient cannot die, suffering patient, the reason this suffering patient wants to die and is suffering, and the reason this patient cannot die is because the feathers in the pillow are keeping the patient alive. That's what they believed. They believed that removing the pillow, removing the cushion, will enable the patient to die. You're not allowed to remove the pillow or the cushion. That's prohibited euthanasia. V'chein lo yazizenu mimkomo. Similarly, you're not allowed to move the patient at all. The slightest movement might kill the patient, and you're not allowed to do that.
We have explained that
for you. You're not allowed to put this, the keys. It's obvious. The keys from the synagogue. The patient who is suffering greatly and wants to die, if you would bring the keys of the synagogue and place them under the patient's head, the keys to the synagogue will enable the patient to open the doors of Olam Haba, the next world, and will enable the soul to depart and will enable the patient to die. You can't, they believed.
What if you're the Russia?
No, it's still, you can't even kill a Russia without a Bet Din.
No, but he's going to go to Olam Haba with the keys in the big
hand. So maybe he'll open the wrong door. I don't know. But they believed that the keys would hasten death. And therefore, you're not allowed to do it. Anything which they believed would hasten death is simply prohibited. Well, today, whatever is, you know, we don't believe these things anymore, but what we do believe today will hasten death. You're not allowed to do anything which will hasten death, not allowed to do anything which will bring death sooner. Simply prohibited.
This is the wrong, right?
This is the wrong.
Same to do it. Having him say vidui, would that be...
No, vidui is okay because that's lutovato. Vidui is okay. Unless, actually it depends. If you are afraid that your relative, your neighbor, your friend, if you are afraid that doing vidui with the patient will upset him, will make him more nervous, will depress him, then it's better than you don't do vidui. You only do vidui with the patient if it's going to help the patient be more calm, if it's going to be of benefit to him.
How about Shema Yisrael?
Same thing.
Why do we have this big list of things here?
Like, the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch are not ones to waste words. They could have said, don't do anything to speed up death. All these examples are great entertainment for us.
Yeah.
But it seems very unnecessary.
Yeah.
It's not obvious, though, all of these things.
Yeah. Yeah,
the reason
the Ramah has all this is because back in those days this was the complete list, and the Ramah wanted the complete list. Nowadays, of course, the list would be very different. Many other things would be on the list in modern medical terms. The next word in the Ramah is the aval. However, which tells us that the Ramah is going to change his mind and reverse everything he's just told us. Aval, however, im yesh sham davar shegoren ikuv yitzias nefesh. If there's something which is blocking the departure of the soul, if there's something which is preventing death, kegon, for example, yesh samuch le'oto bayit kol dofek. For example, next door there is the sound of a wood chopper chopping wood, and the patient is very disturbed by that wood chopper. It's just so disturbing. The patient says, I cannot die. That wood chopper makes me so nervous, I cannot die. The patient is suffering greatly and perhaps wants to die. But the patient cannot die because the noise of the wood chopper is keeping the patient alive. Oshiyesh melach alashono. Well, there's a lump of salt on the patient's tongue. They believed that a lump of salt on the tongue will prolong life. Someone is in a difficult medical condition, go get a lump of salt and put it on his tongue. They thought that the lump of salt would prevent death. Anything which is preventing death, like the lump of salt or the wood chopper, well, let's give a modern example so it sits better with modern minds. Imagine, for example, the elderly grandmother suffering from whatever terminal disease it is, suffering greatly. And imagine this elderly woman who has devoted her entire life, for the last 70 years, every moment of her life, she has devoted to taking care of her family. That's what she has done for the last 70 years. That's what she is, a woman who takes care of her family. And she feels deep in the innermost fibers of her soul, she feels very deeply that if she dies, she'll be a failure to her family. And that tension, that inner emotional tension is keeping her alive, despite the fact that she's suffering greatly. She's still fighting for every moment of life, despite her great suffering, despite the fact that her rational mind tells her death would be better than life. If the family can gather around and explain to her that her death would not be a failure to the family, her death would be a solution to her severe suffering, and she'll be welcome in Olam Haba, if they can calm her down, then she can die peacefully in a few minutes. Of course, morphine will accomplish the same purpose, but you're not allowed, we just learned, you're not allowed to inject the morphine. But the conversation is apparently okay. The point is, Elu Ma'akvin Yitzias HaNefesh, anything which blocks death, Mutal Hasiro, you're allowed to remove it, Misham, from there. Ein bezeh maisa klal, this is not an action at all. Ela mesir hamonea, you're only removing the impediment to death.
Like pulling the plug.
So the Shulchan Aruch, or the Ramah more precisely, the Ramah distinguishes between what is prohibited and what is permitted. What is prohibited is removing the pillow, moving the patient, anything which involves physically moving any part of the patient, that's called actively hastening death and prohibited. Any activity, on the other hand, which does not require physically moving the patient, just go next door and tell the woodchopper to be quiet, assuming for a moment that the patient's mouth is open and that that lump of salt can be removed without actually moving the lips, without actually moving the tongue. Anything which can be done without actually moving, physically moving the patient, is correct if the patient is a gosis and suffering. Now, this is, as you correctly point out, in concept, no different than switching off the ventilating machine. Many of these patients, many terminal patients, need mechanical assistance in breathing, a ventilating machine. If the patient is a gosis and suffering, if the patient's not suffering, so you know, why on earth would you want to do anything? Just let the patient continue to live if there's no suffering. But if the patient is a gosis and suffering, and the only thing keeping this patient alive is the ventilating machine, so switching off the ventilating machine is a simple enough procedure without actually touching the patient. And that's exactly what the Rama is giving his approval to.
Just what I know from watching TV shows about hospitals. It's not that when these ventilating machines are they're usually deep inside the throat.
It can just be switched off. But often we're just talking about a little bit of oxygen being But there are plenty of other cases. Patients who are in terminal stages of whatever disease, typically many of them have very low blood pressure. You know, their hearts aren't working very well. I mean, nothing's working very well. Among the things that don't work very well is the heart. So they have very low blood pressure. And they have infusions. They have medicine shoots into the vein. Dopamine is used. All kinds of medicines which will keep the blood pressure high. Well, if the patient is a gosis and suffering, then and all that's keeping the patient alive is this infusion of dopamine, some medicine being dripped into the veins, an infusion. Well, to stop the dopamine just requires a simple valve. It has to be stopped. The dopamine will stop flowing into the veins. We did this without touching the patient, just like switching off the ventilating machine is done without touching the patient. And presently the patient will die. In the words of the Shulchan Aruch, the soul will depart.
But the example of the turning off a ventilating machine, aren't you really causing the patient to stop moving?
You're removing the impediment of what's keeping the patient alive? The machine. You're removing the thing that is preventing death. The soul wants to depart. The soul is unable to depart.
Physically, something's happening. In other words,
correct.
A physical change.
Correct. Correct. Well. Correct. Now, you're right. But still, this is hasarat hamonea, removing the impediment, and it's defined that way because you are not actually doing anything which touches or affects the body of the patient. Now, all of this, of course, requires that the patient be a gosis. And as we said before, not all the poskim are happy about applying these halachas because it's not all the poskim agree about who is and who is not a gosis.
Could you spell hasarat hamonea on chat, please?
hasarat. Hey, samech. Reish, taf. Hey, samech, reish, taf. New word. Hamonea. Hey, mem. Vav Nun Ayin. Okay, Hasarat Hamonea. But according to those, like Rav David Halevi, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, who asked the doctor, what is keeping this patient alive? This patient is suffering. Why does this patient not die? Because of the dopamine. without this dopamine, aside from a miracle, if we stop the dopamine, this patient will be dead in a few minutes. What's keeping this other patient alive who's suffering? It's the ventilating machine. Without that, aside from a miracle, the patient will die in a few minutes. Well, according to the Shulchan Aruch, the correct thing to do is to switch off the machine or stop the infusion.
Well, it's mutter, it's not...
Mutter. A patient who wishes to fight for every moment of life despite his or her suffering surely has the rights to do so, and surely we would support that decision. But if we're talking about a patient who is suffering and can't handle it anymore, and there's no reasonable expectation, aside from a miracle, there's no reasonable expectation of curing the patient, then we should let the patient die. Of course, if there is some reasonable expectation of a cure, it's correct to perform all kinds of violence on the body of the patient, surgery, whatever is necessary, if there's some reasonable expectation of a cure.
Now, all of that stuff doesn't seem to be appearing here in the Sa'if. It just says
Mutar.
What about the opinion of the patient?
This is not mentioned. Correct.
But we do start with the word Hagoses. So
it has to be a Goses for all this to work.
One problematic area I'm having is with the amount of credibility to the physician. Because, again, my personal experience is if the doctors had their way, my father would have died 15 times since the mid-80s.
Yeah.
They said, you have 5 years to live, then you're going to have another heart attack.
Yeah.
Or if you don't have your other leg amputated, which could kill you in the amputation, it's going to kill you anyway.
Yeah, reliability. Of halachic reliability of physicians is a subject of great controversy. This is worthy of a whole separate discussion. Just in brief, there are poskim like Rav Kook and Rav David Halevi, who was a Talmud of Rav Kook, who hold that physicians should be believed, their statements should be accepted for whatever halachas flow out of whatever they say. We should believe in other great poskim, like the Minchas Yitzchak, who was the head of the Edah Haredit in Mea Shearim for many years. He holds that the doctors, physicians, have no reliability, and their words are to be completely ignored. Some poskim, there's a tshuva indeed of Rav Kook, which suggests a different approach. Rav Kook suggests the approach that the words of physicians should have the halachic status of being suffix. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. After all, in the words of Rav Kook, medical science, it is the nature of medical science that it changes. The history of medical science is the history of discovering that what we always thought was right turns out to be wrong. That's what the whole history of medical science is about. In the words of Rav Kook, medical science works along the following pattern. Dor echad boneh, the dor sheni hores. One generation builds up a medical theory, the next generation tears it down. That was back in those days. Today it goes much faster. Now open up any medical journal and you'll discover that therapies which have been accepted for generations turn out to be either useless or injurious. Open up any medical journal to diverticulitis. Diverticulitis is many people have diverticulitis, an inflammation of the intestines. Many people have it, don't even know it. It's usually a harmless condition which people don't even realize they have either. But some people suffer greatly from diverticulitis. Patients who suffer greatly from diverticulitis for generations have been hospitalized and given treatment for the pain, analgesic treatment, and put on a rigorously a rigorously fiber-free diet until the inflammation of the bowel subsides, and then sent home with instructions to maintain a fiber-free diet for the rest of their lives. These patients typically would bounce in and out of hospital from time to time until it was recently discovered that the cause of diverticulitis is a fiber-free diet, and what the patient needs is a fiber-rich diet. This is just one of thousands and thousands. Why do we read the newspapers? Newspapers are constantly reporting.
He's the one who says we should accept doctors' opinions as rulable.
Rav Kook, Rav Kook also suggested this other approach, Minchas Yitzchak. The lists can be made much longer. Other posts can hold. We just don't believe anything they say. Diane Weiss, of the Ada, he totally rejected them.
I just wanted to point out that when the question came up, following doctors, the issue we were discussing was a gosess. Which I think a doctor is probably much more believable on than in other cases.
Okay.
And they can't, doctors notoriously can't tell you the time, but they can tell you that someone is a
good guess. Okay, this is probably true.
Yeah.
Well, we'll make one further comment. Suffering, we mentioned before that comatose patients are patients regarding whom we do not know what is in the mind of the comatose patient. We mentioned that earlier. And therefore, no one knows. Neurologists would love to know. But we do not know, it is not known, whether or not comatose patients are suffering. Moshe Feinstein points out that anyone who reads this passage in the Shulchan Aruch comes away with the clear impression that the process of separating the soul from the body, that's the way the Shulchan Aruch describes death, right? Death is the separation of the soul from the body. That process of separating the soul from the body is clearly an unpleasant, a painful experience. Anyone who reads this passage in the Shulchan Aruch sees that. And therefore, until proven otherwise, we should assume that comatose patients are suffering. Okay? We should assume that they're suffering until proven otherwise. Now, what we're left with at this point is the idea that there are two kinds of euthanasia. Active euthanasia, actually doing something to the body of the patient which will hasten death, clearly prohibited. On the other hand, passive euthanasia, failing to treat the patient, withholding treatment, withholding treatment from the patient. Passive euthanasia, on the other hand, has the approval of the Shulchan Aruch, assuming we're talking about a gosess who is suffering. So far, so good? Now, let me add one more comment. It says in the verse in the Torah, in Parashat Mishpatim, it says, Rapo Yerape. The Torah says that if I injure someone, I punch him in the face, I have to pay all kinds of things to the person I injured. One of the things I have to pay for are medical costs. I have to pay for medical costs. Well, Mikan, from this, the Gemara learns very quickly that medical treatment is permitted. And the Torah would never command us to pay for medical treatment if medical treatment were prohibited. From this we learn, Nitna Reshut La Rofei L'Rapot. From this pasuk we learn that the Torah permits medical intervention. You know, there's some religions out there where they don't hold this way, but this is the way the rabbis understood the Torah. Medical intervention is permitted. Now that's very nice. The tour is exercised by the following question. Why does the Torah have to permit medical intervention? We surely would have known that because there are a host of other verses in the Torah. Lo ta'amod al dam riecha. The Torah prohibits us from standing and doing nothing while someone is dying. If you can save someone, the Torah commands us to save that person. We should already have had clearly in our minds that medical intervention is permitted. Why did the Torah have to explicitly permit it? That's a problem which exercises the Torah. The Torah answers as follows. Medical intervention is always injurious to the patient. There's no such thing as medical intervention, medicine or surgery. There's no such thing as harmless medicine. There's no such thing as harmless surgery. We needed a verse in the Torah to permit us to inflict a makkah. We needed a verse in the Torah to permit us to inflict a blow on the patient's body in order to treat the patient. That we needed permission of the Torah to do. We wouldn't have known that without an explicit verse in the Torah. Now, it follows, therefore, that if imposing a blow on the body of the patient is not going to be therapeutic, if you're not going to cure the patient, then all you are doing is torturing the patient. And the Torah never permitted that. The Torah never permitted simply prolonging the patient's suffering. That's something the Torah never permitted. The Torah permits us to put the patient through all kinds of pain and suffering if there's some therapeutic value in it. You can even drill holes in the patient's teeth if there's some therapeutic value in it. But if there's no therapeutic value, then all you are doing is torturing the patient, and the Torah never permitted that. It follows, therefore, that if the medical treatment of the patient is doing nothing beyond prolonging suffering, that is something which we never had permission for. Now, as I said before, if the patient wishes to accept upon himself all kinds of suffering, if the patient wishes to accept upon herself this suffering in order to fight for every moment of life, that's something we can smile on. But the patient who refuses treatment, it's surely the right of the patient to refuse treatment. Okay? Ready for the next step? Let's look at the next page. Where is the Minchas Shlomo? Here's the Minchas Shlomo, was the second thing on 38. Al Dvar Hayalda Cholanit. Talking about a sick girl, a young baby.
Wait, is this the Idat Rabbi Scott?
No, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach.
This is
Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach.
Okay.
Regarding a sick girl, question about a sick girl. Nirel ani daiti, it seems in my humble opinion, the kevansha al yaday nituach, if they perform the suggested surgery, that the surgeons suggested some surgery for this girl, if they do perform the surgery, he tishaer chas v'shalom mishuteket l'chol yemei chayeh. Success in the surgery will mean that this girl will be paralyzed for the rest of her life. Failure in the surgery will mean she'll die, but the best result that can be expected from the surgery is to save her life, but she will be paralyzed. No, she can live for a long time, but paralyzed.
No, that's when she had surgery.
No miracle is required here to save her life. We know how to save her life, but she'll be paralyzed. Okay?
To be able to speak.
Able to speak, I suppose, right.
The reason I'm trying to make this distinction is I know someone who had a back injury. At the time, he was told if he had surgery, he most likely would be paralyzed.
Oh.
Without the surgery, he just had back pain.
Oh, okay. That's not this case.
That's why I was asking.
Okay, that's not this case. Gam nosaf lezeh in hatzolah vadeit. Also remember, he says, there's no guarantee that she'll survive surgery. Your surgery is always a life-threatening event. The anesthesia alone, before the first cut is made, Before the first incision, the anesthesia alone is a life-threatening event. All surgery is life-threatening. There's no guarantee that anyone is going to survive surgery. And if she does survive, she will be suffering as a paralyzed patient for the rest of her life. Bichton dan, in a situation like this, mutav, it is preferable. It's preferable to sit and do nothing. That is, not perform the surgery. It's better not to perform the surgery. L'hisha'en al rachami Hashem, depend on God's mercy. Ki rabim rachamav, b'yad adam lo l'hapila. Lo is misspelled. Lo shav an aleph. Lo shav an aleph. The, you see... Now you know how bad a typist I am. That's really a big mistake. You know, my spelling checkers, Hebrew spelling checkers are hopeless, but English spelling checkers catch most of your mistakes. I mean, some things slip by. But Hebrew spelling checkers are hopeless because every misspelling is another word.
and these are not copy-paste.
You can, but that's, it's very expensive software to buy, which I don't have. They have in the office. In the office, they have some expensive software where you can cut and paste this. But I don't have it. No. You can buy a digital version, but it's very expensive. They have in the office, but I don't have it. Yeah, the Bar Ilan version has it, but that's expensive. I don't know. So I'll call upon him. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's position is, given a choice between doing nothing and, aside from a miracle, the patient is going to die, or performing surgery and lengthening the suffering of the patient, better to do nothing and let the patient die.
Being paralyzed, being paralyzed is not physical suffering.
Yeah, it is. He's going to say that in a minute. Hein omnom pashuta baru, it's obvious, and you know, like people like me always get nervous when the poskim think that something is obvious, because then it requires no proof, and you know, someone else might think the opposite is obvious, but he thinks it's obvious. Da'afal gav sha'chayim shal mishutakim. It's obvious that the life of a paralyzed patient, lo aleinu, may that never happen to us, einam klal chayim, the life of a paralyzed patient is no life at all. Lefiha musagim apshutim shelano, in our simple view of things, the life of a paralyzed patient is no life at all. Kashema od koach hasevel shelachole, the paralyzed patient suffers greatly. Gamshel mishpachto, the family suffers a lot. Everyone suffers with a paralyzed patient. Im kolzot hinenu mitzuvim. Nonetheless, we are commanded.
But the family must be physical.
Right. Right, okay, but the family is going to suffer. Despite all that suffering, we are commanded, we are obligated, nonetheless, we must do what we can to lengthen the life of paralyzed patients. You see, we have a little contradiction here. First, he tells us, if the best result of the surgery is going to be paralysis, don't do the surgery. Don't do the surgery and let the patient die. Now he says, if the patient already is paralyzed, for some reason they did the surgery, or maybe some other case where the patient is simply paralyzed, of course we have to be Machal Shabbos. Of course we have to do everything possible to save this patient's life. But that's only after the patient is already paralyzed. Not a contradiction. V'imul cholep chayavim b'vaday l'hizdarez b'hatzalato. A paralyzed person who becomes sick, of course, we'll rush and do whatever we can to help the patient. Gam l'chalal avas ha-shabbos. Of course, we'll even violate Shabbos. Ki ha'inyan shel chayim ein lanu shum k'nei midah. We have no k'nei midah. We have no way of measuring the value of life. Kama limdod et yokram. We have no way of evaluating the value of life. Chashivutam, the importance of life, we cannot evaluate. Afilu lo betorah u'mitzvahs. We can't even evaluate who's going to We do more Torah and more mitzvahs. We have no way of comparing people. Hare Mechalim as a Shabbos. Gamal Zaken Choleh Mukesh Shchin. It's correct to violate Shabbos, even for an elderly patient who has bad skin diseases and is going to die anyway very soon. It's still correct to violate Shabbos. Afal Pishu Cheresh Shota Gomur. Even if the patient is deaf and dumb and insane, right? And a deaf, dumb, insane patient is not going to be doing any mitzvahs, not going to learn any Torah. Still, it's correct to violate Shabbos. Eino yachol lasot shum mitzvah. A patient who's unable to do any mitzvahs, we still violate Shabbos for him. Chayav hemrak lemasav v'sevul gadol mishpachto. Even though his life is going to be one of great suffering, still we do everything we can to lengthen his life. Nekol makom, but still. Ho'il v'sof sof achayim shal mishutakim hem ra'im marim. But still, since imposing paralysis on someone is a very severe imposition, we cannot impose paralysis on anyone. Gam yesh asher tov lahem hamavet me'achayim. Imposing paralysis on someone is making his life worse than death. Lachen b'chton da mistaber she'ein chayivim lasot ma'isa shel nituach b'kum v'aseh. The surgery should not be done. If the patient already is paralyzed, then we'll do everything we can to save the patient. But if the patient is not paralyzed, we will not run the risk of paralyzing the patient. Better not to do the surgery.
What if the patient wants?
Patient wants, patient can accept all kinds of suffering. Go for it. Go for it. Rabbim mitlabtim b'sheila zo. Many great rabbis are mitlabet. Many great rabbis are in a quandary. Many great rabbis are unclear about this question. Tipul b'chol hagoses. Many rabbis are unclear about how to treat terminal patients. Yesh sovrim v'kashem shemachalin shabbos avur chayin sha'a. Some rabbis, and he's talking here about Rav Eliashiv, some rabbis, like Rabbi Eliashiv, think that since it is correct to violate Shabbos for every moment of life that you can provide, then we must force the patient to accept any treatment which will lengthen life. After all, if the Torah commands us to violate Shabbos to lengthen life, we are commanded to violate Shabbos to lengthen life, then the patient has nothing to say about it. And we must force the patient to accept any treatment which will lengthen his life. Ki hu eino ba'alim al atzmo. The patient is not his own owner. Only God owns our bodies, and the patient does not own his own body. Livater al rega achat. The patient cannot forego even a single moment of life. Now this is the opinion of Rav Eliashiv. He doesn't mention Rav Eliashiv by name, but that's who he's talking about. Rav Eliashiv always held that if anything can be done to lengthen the life of the patient, even for a moment, despite any suffering, since it is correct to violate Shabbos to do that, since we are commanded to violate Shabbos to do that, the patient's desires, one way or another, have nothing to do with it, and even against the patient's will, we must do everything to lengthen life. Some rabbis hold that position. Now, you know Shylock? Shakespeare's well, mm-hmm. Shakespeare arrived in other countries already. The Shakespeare, Shylock, everyone knows Shylock, right? The Merchant of Venice. Of course, one wonders, the name of the play is The Merchant of Venice. Who exactly is the Merchant of Venice in the play? That's something to think about. But let's skip to the trial where Portia is the judge. The question arises, what would be in a Bet Din, what would be the halacha if the trial of Portia occurred before rabbis in a rabbinic Bet Din? This question was first addressed by one of the great rabbis of the 20th century, Rav Shlomo Zevin. Rosh Shlomo Zevin, he, among other things, was the editor of the Encyclopedia Talmudit. He was one of the heavyweights of the 20th century. He wrote shelves full of very important books. In one of his books, he deals with the trial of Shylock, how it would be treated from a halachic point of view. His bottom line conclusion is that since according to the halacha, we are not owners of our bodies, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the owner of our bodies, therefore the whole contract of Shylock is invalid, and therefore the trial of Shylock could not proceed as portrayed by Shakespeare. That's the opinion of Rav Zevin, and that's an opinion which is embraced by Rav Elyashiv, and that's the Yesh Mitlaptim. Those are the rabbis that he's referring to here, rabbis like Rav Elyashiv and Rav Zevin. On the other hand, other rabbis like Rav Shaul Yisraeli, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, he was for many years the Rav of Kfar HaRoeh. He was for many, many years. We learned at Tzitz Eliezer, he was the head of the chief of the Bet Din HaGadol, the Rabbanut HaRashit. That was the Tzitz Eliezer from yesterday. His co-chief judge was Shaul Yisraeli. They sat together on the court. For around 30 years, they sat together on the court. Rav Shaul Yisraeli was also one of the big names in the 20th century. He published an article fiercely attacking the position of Rav Zevin, holding that Al Pi Din, according to Halacha, we are owners of our own bodies, and therefore a contract can be made regarding ownership of body parts. Remember, around 20 years ago, there was a big movement here in medical circles in Israel. Medical circles here in Israel were pushing the government to sign an international agreement, an international treaty, limiting sahar be'evarim, limiting international trade in organs. The Israeli Medical Association wanted the Israeli government to sign this agreement, and Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, where I worked at the time, Shaarei Tzedek Hospital organized a conference on this topic in order to work up some rabbinic approval of the idea, trying to convince the government to agree to the international treaty preventing trade in human organs for financial benefit. They made the horrible mistake of inviting Rav Shaul Yisraeli to address the conference. He was a very short man in stature, with a very high-pitched voice, and he stood there haranguing the doctors. Everyone owns his own body, and if someone wants to sell his organs, it's your right to sell your organs. You want to sell your blood, it's your right. Your blood, it's your right to sell it. Just as with medicines, if the government sees fit to regulate the trade, so let the government see fit to regulate the trade. But they're your organs and you can sell them. Well, you see, we have before us a huge machloket, a huge division among the rabbis. Those who on the one hand hold, it's not my body to make, therefore I cannot make decisions about prolonging my life. It's not my life to make decisions about, and therefore I am obligated to accept any therapy which is going to prolong my life, as opposed to the others who hold, well, it is my body and it is my life, and therefore if I do not wish to suffer anymore, I have the right to refuse treatment. That's a big machlokus. Let's finish up this tshuva. Ach mistaber, it seems reasonable. She'im achole sovel mekevim yisurim gedalim. If the patient is suffering a lot, or afilu sevel nefesh chazak, even if it's not physical suffering, even if it's emotional suffering, Choshvani, I think, she'ochel v'chamsan v'nishima chayivim laten. You have to give oxygen, and you have to give food. Gam neged ritzono, even if the patient doesn't want. Now, depriving a patient of oxygen is causing great pain. You try it yourself. You hold your breath for a while, and you'll realize it begins to hurt. Right? Depriving a patient of oxygen, that's causing great suffering. Administering oxygen relieves suffering for a patient who's deprived of oxygen, for a patient who has respiratory problems. Oxygen you have to give. You're not allowed to starve someone to death. Oxygen and food are not, strictly speaking, medical interventions. You might have a nasal gastric feeding tube, you know, like one of these tubes that goes in through the nose down into the stomach and the food gets shot in through it. You know, it might be some complicated mechanism which gets the food into the patient. It might be some complicated machine which gets the oxygen into the patient. But air and food are not in the category of medical therapy. That's perfectly natural. Ordinary people who are perfectly healthy have oxygen and have food. That's not called medical therapy, and therefore we cannot withhold food and oxygen. Afal mutal himana mitrufot hagormot sevel l'chole, im ha'chole doresh et zeh. But medicines which are prolonging suffering, administering the medicine is going to prolong suffering. If the patient doesn't want the medicine, the patient has the right to refuse. Ulam, amachole yireshemai, lo nitrofadato. If the patient is religious and of clear mind, ratzui ma'od l'hasbirlo. It's of course proper to explain to the patient. It's of course correct to explain to the patient that from the religious point of view, one moment of life in this world is worth more than the whole of the next world. Of course, hashkafically, one should try to convince the patient to accept the therapy, but if the patient says no, it's his right to say no.
Is that considered like a suicide?
Yes, except he's just removing the impediment to death. He's not actually doing anything, and therefore it's okay.
If the medical staff said that the administration of food would actually hasten the patient's death.
Yeah, sure. Of course, obviously, there are patients who have difficulty with swallowing. Yeah, well, just swallowing. They could choke on the food, or they have digestive problems. Obviously, these patients are going to need some kind of infusion instead. And that would be medical. That's medical intervention, infusion.
I wouldn't necessarily call refusal of food suicide, because many patients at the end just don't want to eat. Are not hungry.
They can't.
They just don't want the food.
The hospice experience, you know, hospices are somewhat controversial, but it is claimed by the staff in the hospice movement, it is claimed that quality of life can be improved and length of life can be improved, number one, by not administering medicines, and number two, by not administering food. What they do is, you know, every patient is different, but in general, hospice procedure, both in North America and in Israel, hospice procedure is to infuse fluids subcutaneously. You know, there are different ways that fluids can be put into the body. You can have into an intravenous, into a major vein, or you can put the fluids just under the skin with a very small needle. The fluids which are introduced just under the skin, subcutaneous infusion, it's much more pleasant for the patient. It's much more pleasant. Far fewer complications. There are only two objections. There are only two problems with subcutaneous infusion. usually sugar water is what they use, or saline, salt water. The only two objections to subcutaneous infusion are, number one, you can't get so much fluid into the body. It's about a liter a day, tops, whereas into the veins you can put in more. And every patient's different how much they need. And also the patients which do need medicines, some patients have horribly high blood pressure, and without blood pressure medication they suffer great headaches and so forth. So some patients need, terminal patients need the medication even in hospice. The list of medications which can be infused subcutaneously is a fairly short list. The list of medicines which can go straight into a vein is a very long list. So there are two minor objections to subcutaneous infusion, but for most patients, it's a good solution, a good approach. They don't have to eat. And indeed, according to the hospice people, the quality of life improves, the length of life improves without eating.
Okay, I'm just talking about patients that just refuse to eat. Both my parents went through that.
Very common.
Without any infusions or anything. They just at some point said, enough.
The patient doesn't
want they wanted to die?
No. They're not. Well, the body shuts down and just doesn't want the food anymore. They're not hungry. They don't want to eat.
Very, very common with terminal patients.
In fact, that's one of the signs at the end of the year when the patient starts to eat.
It's also true with non-terminal patients. They're patients who have every expectation of recovery from whatever therapy it is, but they have to be forced to eat. I mean, you have to really fight to get every gram into them. And then, like in a few months, they recover, and then they're back to normal. But the sick people don't like to eat. It happens. Tov, that's the position of Rav Shlomo Zalman. Now, it's perfectly clear, is it not, that Rav Shlomo Zalman falls squarely in the category of those rabbis who gives approval to passive euthanasia, that is, doing nothing and letting the patient die. That's what the case is all about, and bottom line, that's his position. Now, one wonders whether or not this is the unique position of one of the great contemporary rabbis, or is this a position which has broader support in the rabbinic world? Let's take a look at what the Igros Moshe, Reb Moshe Feinstein, has to say on this issue. And these two personalities, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and the Igros Moshe, together, they are the two most influential rabbis in modern times. Igros Moshe says as follows: Hatam shemutal lehasir davar ha-ma'akev yitzias ha-nefesh. The reason that the Shulchan Aruch taught us that it is correct to remove the impediment to death, the reason the Shulchan Aruch told us that it's correct to let the patient die, kishein b'zeh maisa, as long as you're not performing any action on the body of the patient, mishum yisurin, it's all because of suffering. You're not allowed to unnecessarily impose suffering on the patient. Of course, with some reasonable expectation of a cure or treatment, so you do whatever you have to do, but with no reasonable expectation of a cure, terminal patient, all you're doing is causing more suffering, and that you're not supposed to do. Im haya mutar la'asot emtzeim la'harich chaye sha'a af kishiyu lo yisurin. Since the Shulchan Aruch approves of removing the impediment to death, we know that there's no obligation to lengthen the life of the suffering patient. It's simply prohibited, he says, to do anything which will lengthen the unnecessary suffering of the patient. Stam ikuv yitzias nefesh begoshes, goses hu yisurin. A goses, someone who's a terminal patient, is stam. Stam means we assume that the patient is suffering until proven otherwise. A goses, a terminal patient, usually it's perfectly clear that the patient is suffering, but if it's not clear one way or another whether the patient is suffering, stam, we assume. If the patient is suffering until proven otherwise, and there's no reason to do anything to lengthen that suffering. He has exactly the same idea at the bottom of the page. Be'inchi, regarding people. Be'inchi, regarding people. She'rofim makirim, where physicians recognize. Where the physicians recognize that it's impossible for these people to be cured and to live. Af lo sheyichye kemoshu chole b'lo yisurin, impossible for this patient to recover and be relieved of suffering. Aval efshar liten lo samei refuah, but it is possible to administer medicines laharich yamav, to lengthen his days. Kemoshu nimtza ata b'yisurin, it is possible to administer treatment which will lengthen the patient's life in suffering. Ein liten lo mine refuot, one should not administer the therapy. Ella, rather, yanihum kemoshem, leave them be as they are and let them die. The Igros Moshe agrees exactly with the Minchas Shlomo, who agrees exactly with the position of the Shulchan Aruch that passive euthanasia is the way to go. That's correct in cases where the patient is a goses and suffering.
Not a
goses, but suffering. Not a goses, but suffering. Not a goses means there's some reasonable expectation of curing this patient.
They're in chronic pain. Even more people would not help.
Yeah, no, there's no reason, no need to lengthen that suffering. Now, of course, they're all different.
But they're not dying.
They're all different ways.
It's not going to cause death.
They're all different. You know, something else. They're all different degrees of suffering. But I've often heard physicians ask patients, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much does it hurt?
They moved it down to 5.
Yeah, Toby said, I mean the whole question sounds to me absurd. I mean, how, you know, if a physician asked me, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much are you suffering, I wouldn't begin to know.
It's not suffering, it's pain.
On earth would I respond to a question like that?
A 10 is the worst pain that you can possibly imagine.
Okay. In any event, there surely are levels of pain, whether we have a clear way of measuring them or not. Is another question. There surely are different levels of pain. But according to the Igros Moshe, according to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, is the patient required to accept medical therapy? The answer is no. Now this is a slightly different question from the question of passive euthanasia. Even if life and death is not an issue, the patient is never required to accept therapy. The reason the patient is never required to accept therapy is because there's no such thing as a therapy which is 100% certain to relieve suffering. And a patient who does not wish to accept that risk upon himself or upon herself has the right to say, no therapy, please. This point of view is the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer, his family name is Bornstein. In the yeshiva world, that family name is unknown. You talk about the opinion of Rabbi Bornstein, no one will know who you're talking about. It's called the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer was the Rav of Sochaczew in Poland. Before World War I, he was a great Hasidic Rebbe, and in addition to being a great Hasidic Rebbe, he was the greatest of the poskim of Poland before World War I. In the second to last tshuva, I don't remember the tshuva number, in the second to last tshuva in the Chosha Mishpat section, he has the following approach to the issue. According to the Ramban, according to the Ibn Ezra, and a number of other Rishonim, all medical therapy is always prohibited. All medical therapy is always prohibited, according to the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra. All medical therapy is prohibited. The Torah gives permission to the physician to treat the patient, but the Torah never gave permission to the patient to be treated. If the physician treats the patient, the physician is off the hook for having committed a sin, but the patient is still guilty of improper medical intervention. In the words of the Ramban, Ein makom lirofe bevet Hashem, there's no room for a physician in a Torah community.
Did he really say that?
I just quoted his words, yes.
Okay. Not anyone, this is not anyone quoting him.
No, this is the Ramban. Ramban. Ibn Ezra holds the same thing. And Ibn Ezra, incidentally, had a life of suffering. Ibn Ezra suffered greatly through his life. You know, it's so difficult to diagnose diseases in earlier... Sometimes you read the disease... and about a disease in antiquity, in the Middle Ages, sometimes you read about a disease and anyone who's familiar with the disease recognizes it immediately. But that's unusual. Usually the descriptions of diseases are so vague in ancient and medieval sources that we don't know exactly what disease they were talking about. But the Ibn Ezra suffered greatly through his life and holding, like the Ramban, that medical therapy is simply prohibited. He never sought medical therapy.
What troubled him? How was he suffering?
He had yisurin v'sevel gadol, so vague that we don't know what it is he had.
And he didn't change his sabbath.
No, he didn't.
So we shouldn't be asking the patient to make any decisions for himself on this.
Okay.
It's always
okay. This is the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra. Rambam, on the other hand, and Rashba, Rambam and Rashba hold that medical therapy is a subcategory of the mitzvah of restoring lost property. If you find an object that someone lost, there's a mitzvah to restore, to return the lost property to the person who lost it. All the more so are we obligated to restore someone's health if we can. Because he was a physician.
Yeah.
No, he wrote this before he was a physician. Okay. The Rambam began life as a pearl in the pearl business. He was a pearl importer. The Rambam was in the pearl business together with his brother. His brother traveled to India and bought the pearls and brought them back to Egypt. And Rambam would market the pearls in Egypt. The brother went to India, and Rambam was the brother in Egypt. They had a pearl business until the brother's ship sank at sea with all the pearls, and the brother was lost at sea. That put the Rambam out of the pearl business, and only late in his life, since he was no longer in the pearl business, he had to seek some other source of livelihood, since he held that it's prohibited to accept any money for Torah. Since he happened to have read every medical text known in the world in those days, he became a physician.
No, he felt that healing is
obligatory.
Obligatory, therefore a mitzvah that he would accept money for?
No. No.
So
the Shulchan Aruch also prohibits accepting money for medical treatment.
I saw this video by the Beryl Wine Foundation.
Yes.
And there's a part of it, it's a children's movie, but there's a part of it where someone says to the wife of the Rambam, who was like his secretary, oh, so much money to charge, and then she says, there's a famous line, the doctor is not worth anything unless you, it says like, how does it go? Like, he's only worth what you pay him.
Asya b'mogen merape, b'mogen shavya, in other words, the Gemara. The physician who heals for free is worthless.
Right. Yeah. So he charged.
Yeah. No. Yeah. The story is a fictional story.
he did not charge for his medical services. He said he didn't charge for Torah.
He charged only for his
time.
For his time. Oh. As in, yeah. How much could I be making if I were working in another profession? His loss of income. His time he charged for, that's all.
Two related questions.
Yeah.
First, a goses who is being kept alive by a ventilator. You cannot remove that ventilator because that will hasten his death. Is that correct?
Correct.
Second, there's a power outage. The ventilator stops.
You don't have to switch it on.
You don't have to put it back on, right?
Yeah, no different than the bottle of medicine which is being infused into the patient's veins, keeping him alive. When the bottle runs out, you don't have to put another one.
You don't have to refill it again.
Yeah.
But according to Shulchan Aruch...
Well, what about the specific example? The specific example of the Igros Moshe is the ventilated patient, the patient on a breathing machine. This is the specific example he gives. Patients who are on breathing machines obviously have difficulty breathing, or they wouldn't need a breathing machine, right? And therefore, patients who are on breathing machines often have accumulation of fluids and in the breathing passages, and therefore regularly need to be suctioned out. So you have to clean out the breathing, which means that at irregular times, the nurses have to turn off the breathing machine and use suction to clean out the breathing passages, and then they can turn the breathing machine back on again. Once the breathing machine is off, that's the time, the Igros Moshe writes, to see whether or not the patient has any autonomous breathing, whether or not there's any automatic breathing. If there's no automatic breathing, there's no reason to reattach the machine.
I thought, according to the Shulchan Aruch, you said that turning off the ventilator was simply removing an impediment. In which case, it would be
that's
okay.
Different than removing the tube from from his throat if he's intubated.
If I may be allowed to sketch out a scenario to help me see if I've got all the different pieces clearly in mind. Take the case of a relatively elderly woman suffering from a variety of ailments, including Alzheimer's, which causes terrible suffering, but would not put the woman in the category of a ghostess because the Alzheimer's itself is not going to kill her.
Right. But the demented patients suffer a lot.
Right. But from this, I might be able to say that such a woman would not be required to take her blood pressure medicine or her diabetes.
Correct.
Treatment.
You're just prolonging suffering.
And that would hasten the death.
Yeah, yes and no. It depends upon the following question. If we were talking here about a patient who is salul b'da'ata, of clear mind, and the patient says, I do not want the blood pressure machine, the blood pressure medicine, which is keeping me alive. I want to end my suffering. That's the right of the patient. But here we have a patient who cannot make a rational decision by herself because the patient is unfortunately demented. And when the patient is demented, then some way has to be found to figure out what the patient would have wanted. Now here rabbis are divided on the question of living wills. Someone who writes out clear instructions when they're still of sound mind, still clear-headed. The patient writes out instructions, if I ever become demented, I want such and such and such, I refuse this and I refuse that and I don't want... Is that valid? Is this a valid way of establishing what the patient would really think when the patient gets into that situation? Or is it reasonable to think the patient would change his mind when he gets into that situation? Here, rabbis are divided on the validity of living wills. Something has to be done to figure out what the patient would want in a case like that. It might not be possible to figure it out. Well, let me just finish the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer, we have these two approaches of the Rishonim. Those who reject the medical therapy, say it's wrong to go to doctors, period. And those who say it's a mitzvah to restore health through medical therapy, given this machloket, the Avnei Nezer says any individual can choose to depend upon God and follow the opinion of the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra and reject medical therapy. That's a right which every patient has. Let me point out in passing that the Avnei Nezer had a son, the Shem Shmuel, one of the important Hasidic, the son was also a Hasidic Rebbe, the Shem Shmuel. The Shem Shmuel had a son-in-law. The son-in-law had tuberculosis, and the Shemesh Shmuel wrote a letter to his son-in-law as follows. It's almost Yom Kippur. Your physician has instructed you to eat on Yom Kippur. Don't think of yourself as being a tzaddik who is going to fast on Yom Kippur and endanger your life. You must accept the advice, you must accept the instructions of the physician. The yesod, the foundation of Avodas Hashem, the foundation of serving God, according to Shem Shmuel, is being mavatel, canceling, eliminating your own desires and following the desires of Torah. And since Torah says v'chai b'hem, you should live by doing the commandments and not die by doing the commandments, son-in-law, you have to accept the instructions of the physician. So this is the son of the Avi Nezer who published the tshuva, who said everyone has the right to refuse medical advice. If you're ever wondering whether or not the children have some obligation to accept the halachic opinions of their fathers, here we have a counterexample, but you don't exactly need this counterexample, because there's a whole page in Masechet Chulin, a whole page of examples, one after another, of great rabbis who departed from the, who disagreed with the opinions of their fathers. Apparently it's okay. Tov, in any event, we've run out of time. As usual, I talk too much. Tomorrow, of course, is a tinul, and on Thursday, we're going to meet again. Yeah, we're gonna do a presence of the husband in the delivery room next time. Okay.
Where is that letter?
It's in the Sefer Shem Shmuel, the volume called Mo'adim, and it's used just to fill up the last page.
There's a change of material too. Change of material.